You're listening to a podcast from 702.
As I said this morning, there is a normative tension in liberal democracies between what you would have been taught in term one of politics, which is to say that the first duty of the state is to keep you and I safe. On the other hand, you would also have been taught in politics or law, or just your own experience as a citizen, even if you haven't gone to university, that freedom matters. And what happens when the state says, I need, or we need as government, the following mechanism in order to keep you secure. But the cost of that mechanism is that we reduce your freedom. There'd be freedom of movement. That might happen under state of emergency. You should be careful what you call for. Or, in the case of RICA, your privacy, for example, might be compromised because someone is effectively spying on you, and they do so purportedly to try and keep the nation safe. So what is the right mechanism to strike that balance between legitimate competing interests in a democracy? There's a legitimate interest you and I as citizens have to have maximum freedom, including privacy, and the state has legitimate interest and, in fact, a duty to be able to keep you and I safe. That is the crux of what we're going to look at this hour in light of a really interesting local division, South Gauteng High Court case that have found the state wanting in terms of the details of specifically RICA, the Regulation of Interception of Communications and Provisions of Communications Related Information Act. Now, someone who has been absolutely brilliant on the details of this from a legal point of view, journalism point of view, and in terms of the ethics, for many years now, has been Professor Jane Duncan, who's a professor in the Department of Journalism, Film and Television at the University of Johannesburg, and she's going to be my anchor guest for the entire hour in studio with me. Professor Duncan, always enjoy following your work, and I'm grateful that you're here in studio with us. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Eusebius. Thank you for the invitation.
And then I'm grateful to a couple of other guests who will pop in and out of the conversation, particularly that they've been able to say yes at short notice. And in fact, I want to start with the first of them before I introduce another guest that is based in England. But first and foremost, I want to start with a journalist, because I think we need to give a practical example of why this matters. And in fact, it's his experience that was at the heart of this particular case that has now been making its way through the legal system, and no doubt will continue to do so if the state were to appeal this particular judgment. And I'm talking about Sam Soule, who's a journalist and also managing director of Mabungane Center for Investigative Journalism. Sam, good morning to you, and thank you so much for coming on the Eusebius McKaiser Show. I really appreciate it.
No, it's a great pleasure. It's nice to celebrate this interim victory with you and your listeners.
Absolutely. It's very important. Before we do the celebration, can I trigger you by asking you to tell the public how it came to be that you had a hunch or knew that perhaps you yourself are under surveillance?
Okay. Well, look, it's a long story. And I mean, this case has been, you know, more than 10 years in a way, in preparation and in building. And that question is a key part of our case, because normally you never know. It's like, and this is the example I use, at least when police get a search warrant for your premises, you don't know beforehand. They go to a judge in secret and give him the basis on which they want to search. But when they actually carry out the search at your home, you know about it, and then you can challenge that search warrant afterwards. With electronic surveillance, you never know they've been in your home, they've been in your electronic life, which, as we know, is nowadays really extensive. So in around 2008, I had information that I was under surveillance. We kind of tried to take it up. Then in 2009, when I was working for the Mail and Guardian, myself and my co-managing partner at Amabungane, Stefan Brummer, we had, you know, quite a few indications that our communications were intercepted. We actually lodged a formal complaint with the Inspector General of Intelligence, mm-hmm. and that process went on for ages, and eventually basically they came back and said, we've investigated, we found nothing wrong, but they wouldn't even confirm whether we had been surveilled or not. All they would say is, we investigated if anybody did anything, they did it in terms of the rules. Then, when in 2015, April 2015, at the height of the Zuma spy tapes saga, it emerged publicly that my communications had been intercepted in 2008. And what happened was Michael Hulley, the attorney then for President Jacob Zuma, he attached extracts from intercepted conversations between myself and Billy Downer in 2008. Billy Downer had been the lead prosecutor in the Shake trial, sort of part of the Scorpions in investigation of the arms deal. And I think that Mr. Hulley tried to make something of this communication between the NPA and the journalist, although it was really rather tame. But that was the first time we were able to prove, to show from official records that my communications had been intercepted. And using that, we launched a PIA application to the State Security Agency to try and get them to release the basis. You know, what was the motivation given to the judge?
Said he, and at that point, Sam, given that history, when you make that that Promotion of Access to Information Act application, how much in terms of its attitude and behavior was there a willingness then to be reason-bound and to be committed to transparency?
No, you're talking about the spy agency. look, it was a long process, which, you know, PIA has certain deadlines which they consistently missed, etc. Eventually, they wouldn't give us the motivation, but they did give us a copy of the judge's order, which showed that my phone had been intercepted for a total of about six months. That's all we got.
My goodness. I want to bring in Professor Jane Duncan here. Sam has given us a rich textured backstory to how he came to know that something is up here. I want to separate two sets of issues and tell me whether one needs to spend any time on the first, which is the normative architecture of this discussion. Do we all accept, or is work still to be done from a public information and discussion point of view on the following, that there's an inherent tension that we must live with between the duty to keep us safe and our desire as individuals and as journalists in our work, lawyers even, to have maximum freedom. But the real question is the second one, isn't it? How does that tension play out on a day-by-day basis with agencies like the State Security Agency, and what is a mechanism? So we can agree the principles are important and intention rather than contradictory. That's part of a democracy. But it's the detail of the mechanisms that matter, right? And the behavior of the state.
I'd largely agree with that, Eusebius. I would say that there is a certain discussion to have about the first normative position, which is that we are a country that doesn't face a significant terrorism threat at the moment. And consequently, because of that, we can't, or the state agencies can't make an argument that fundamental rights like privacy and freedom of expression should give way excessively to the right of the state to undertake communication surveillance, for instance.
That makes sense, right? And the judgment agrees with you because it is very clear that these kinds of requests should be granted only under ideally exceptional circumstances. And in a sense, jurisprudentially, it affirms your view by suggesting that there should be a presumption in favor of more rather than less freedom.
Absolutely, yes. And I actually don't think that we're in that fairly fortunate position globally because of anything significant that the security agencies have done. I think it's a big foreign policy win. I think after the 9/11 attacks in the US and the 7/7 attacks in the UK, South Africa took a strategic foreign policy decision to not align itself largely with the war against terror. So we were neither with them nor against them. And I think that that is probably the single biggest factor that has led to us not having a significant terrorism threat. And consequently, it becomes more difficult for the security security agencies to make an argument that they need excessive powers, emergency powers, effectively, in order to protect us.
Before we get to the mechanism, I agree with you that some of the normative discussion or the principle discussion does require a little bit of finesse and sticking with that before we get into the specifics of how do you allow the state to gather information to keep us safe. This judgment for me was also really a beautiful one, Jane, because there was also here an echo with some of the early constitutional court judgments that have been very clear that one of the important breaks with pre-1994 South Africa is that we should be, and that's why I was asking Sam, and he rightly sneered because the state doesn't always respect this, there should be a reason-bound way in which the state respond to you and me when we ask them, hey, what are you doing and why are you doing what you're doing?
Yes, absolutely. And there should be a legitimate and overriding public interest in order to override fundamental rights like privacy and freedom of expression. Absolutely.
Can you take 2 or 3 minutes and just slowly explain to the public on the mechanism? There were a couple of questions that the court grappled with here. Do you inform Sam? Who do you go to? A judge or someone else to say, I would like to listen to Sam's breakfast conversation with Stefans. How often do you go back to then have that right to be listening in on those conversations and intercept communications renewed periodically? Just the nuts and bolts, because again, I thought it was a very lucid judgment that laid out about 4 or 5 elements from seeking permission to effectively conduct surveillance, going back to have that permission renewed, and then the crucial question, what happens to that data once it exists? Who owns it? What can it be used for? Talk us through some of those mechanism elements.
I can certainly do so. Can I maybe just make 2 preliminary points before I do so? The first is that I think we need to disabuse a view that appears to have developed in the public. I've certainly picked up on it in social media, that RICA's been thrown in the dustbin. RICA hasn't been thrown in the dustbin. RICA remains very much alive and well. It's just certain sections that have been declared constitutionally invalid, and most of them, in fact, have been suspended for a period of 2 years to allow the legislature to correct those deficiencies. So, yes, RICA is still in operation.
Can I just ask a clarificatory question there? My apology. So it's not that those bits that were declared unconstitutional were suspended, but that the declaration of invalidity itself is suspended pending Parliament fixing it. So it operates as normal until it's been fixed. Is that right, Sam?
You see, there's a code I could add to that.
Okay.
The judge has made rulings as to how the law should be read in or operate in the interim,
okay,
which effectively extends all the protections that we asked for. He said the final decision has to come from Parliament, but in the meantime, most of what we asked for,
yes,
he has said, should operate in the interim.
Okay, that makes sense.
All right. So, yes, you still need to go and get your SIM card registered. You still need to get RICA'd, sadly. And I can get onto the sadly bit perhaps a little bit later on into the discussion. The second point that I'd like to make is that I think the whole country, and in fact, even beyond our borders, we are in debt, I think, to Samsol and the Amabungani Center, because they could have made it about Samsol. Mm-hmm. He could have litigated narrowly on the specifics of his particular case. And I'm sure that he would have won his case. But he decided, or they decided, to take a little bit more time and turn this his specific set of circumstances outwards in order to raise broader systemic issues about how the regulation of interception of communications is dealt with. Now, just in terms of the specific mechanisms, for me, possibly the most important aspects of the judgment that were made yesterday are that if there is an interception direction or a warrant that's issued for the interception of your communications, you need to, as a default position, be informed within 90 days of the warrant lapsing. So in other words, once the warrant has reached a non-sensitive stage, there is a process that the judge has now put in place for if there is an ongoing investigation, for instance, and it would be a legitimate threat to that investigation for that person to be informed, then there can be a deferral of notification. Mm. And if the deferral moves beyond 3 years, then there needs to be a panel of judges to consider the application for that deferral. This, for me, is probably the most significant mechanism that's been increasingly recognized internationally in order to shine a light on decisions that have been taken about who is being intercepted and on what basis. Because if you know your communications have been intercepted on improper grounds, then you can actually go and you can take the state on review. So it's a beautiful mechanism that allows a spotlight to be shone on whether proper decisions are being taken. There was also an issue raised about the independence of the RICA judge. Now, one of the positive things about RICA, which I think makes RICA a good law, is that we have judicial authorization of warrants. But the judge lacks independence because the judge is appointed on an annual basis by the Minister of Justice, which effectively makes the judge beholden to the Minister of Justice. Mm. And what the judge pointed out yesterday was that that introduces intolerable political interference into the process. Now, the applicants had argued that a better process, a more independent process, is to have the Judicial Services Commission select that judge. But then the judge yesterday said that actually there's a reasonable compromise where the Chief Justice can nominate the RICA judge for a non-renewable term of 2 years, and then the Minister of Justice can appoint and is duty-bound to appoint. So I think that was a big win.
Did they deal with the following practical concern?
Mm.
That the process, which is part of what Sam and his colleagues' team had also raised as a red flag, is non-adversarial in the sense that I go as a spook to this judge appointed for a non-renewable two-year term, and I say, listen, Oak, because it's one person, I think that Jane is a serious threat to our democracy. Here are my reasons why I want to be able to intercept her communication. Now, there's a conundrum here. If I play devil's advocate, let's say Jane is potentially a suicide bomber. I wouldn't want to ask Jane, hey, Jane, please come here to Bromfontein and contest what this man is saying about you. On the other hand, it is impossible for that single adjudicator to make a judgment call on what is not before him. So he gets a one-sided view in determining whether or not to grant permission for you to be surveilled. How does one square that conundrum of not wanting the spooks to give their game away, but still wanting you an opportunity to have some sort of say about this person seeking permission to curtail your freedom?
That is a significant systemic problem with how the whole RICA process works. And the judge can be lied to and has been lied to. We know of at least one case where incorrect information, it involved two Sunday Times, former Sunday Times journalists now, where incorrect information was placed in front of the judge and the judge just signed off on that interception direction. There are mechanisms to deal with that particular problem. Yesterday's judgment was a bit lukewarm on the issue of introducing a public advocate in order to, you know, have more of an adversarial process and more of an interrogative process that is more aligned to what happens in ordinary courts. And I take the points that the judge was making. However, I think that there is still grounds for innovations like introducing an amicus curiae or an expert witness, because judges often aren't technically proficient.
No.
And you need to be taking technically proficient decisions about interception directions. Also, I think what the judge alluded to and what we could potentially consider in future is having a panel of judges, not just for hearing applications for the non-notification of individuals, but having a panel of judges that can then quarrel with one another.
Absolutely.
And have several eyes on, several eyes on an application process.
Makes
and,
sense.
You know, the judge yesterday did leave the door open to that possible innovation.
I want to introduce into the conversation here the legal officer for Privacy International, and I'm grateful to Dr. Ilya Siatitsa, who is part of this conversation as well. Ilya, good morning to you. Thank you for agreeing to come on the show. I really appreciate your presence.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very happy to join.
I want to ask you.
Interesting conversation.
Yeah, I want to ask you two questions to start off with. Firstly, your general reaction to the judgment, because you've been involved in this case. And then secondly, a more precise question. There was an interesting press statement released by the Right to Know campaign, signed by various stakeholders, yourself included. And it ended with a very important widening of this discussion and this case by saying that this isn't only about privacy and security, but that this victory connects the right to privacy, which your organization obviously exists to promote, to other values in democracies, including, interestingly, dignity itself. So your reaction and then an articulation of why privacy matters and what the connection is between privacy and other values like dignity and democracy more generally.
Well, on your first question, we consider that this is a historical judgment because particularly on the question of bulk interception, it is a powerful rejection of years of secret and unchecked surveillance by South African authorities against millions of people, irrespective of whether they reside in South Africa. It has been for at more than 10 years now that whistleblowers and journalists have been reporting on such mass interception surveillance programs across the globe. And the governments have been refusing to avow these programs. And it has taken significant amount of pressure to shed light on these practices. And so we are grateful to some for taking that step and pushing the case further. And the court has given an irreversible no to mass interception, and that runs unchecked. So this has been for us an immense step forward that we are hoping will also influence legal procedures that are that are ongoing at the moment, the European continent. With regard to this, your second question.
Yeah, the reason I asked it is we take things for granted until they are taken away. And it may be trite for you as an expert to know instinctively or to be able to go to a podium and articulate the value of privacy. But sometimes people just do not give these things a second thought until there is a slow creep of authoritarianism that happens inside the state. Why is privacy so important, and what's its link to democracy's health?
It is actually very, very accurate. We all often tend to disregard the importance of privacy, not only on its own value, but actually as a right that facilitates the enjoyment of other rights, and as a right that actually permits and facilitates democratic participation, and this is very, very, very important. Because as we often say, every human rights violation often starts with a violation of privacy. And quite often we tend to focus on the end result, which might be an impact on the right to life or even torture. And we tend to neglect the fact that if there were privacy safeguards in place to begin with, certain violations could have been prevented.
That's a very good point, yeah. I want to take a quick break there just because I've got to go to my news colleagues earlier, but I'm going to keep you on the line. I've got one more question for Sam. Sam, I know we've had you longer than I have asked for, but I want to ask you a question about the impact on journalism for the public to understand why this matters for journalism, which itself is important for the health of democracy. But it's 28 minutes before 11 o'clock.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
On 702.
26 minutes before 11 o'clock. Sam, just a final question to you. We've spoken a little bit about some of the principled issues, the normative issues. We've spoken about the legalities around this and your own personal case. Why does this matter for journalism, and why should the public not have schadenfreude when journalists lose cases like this? And why is this fundamentally about the country and not just about Sam Sol and Amabungane?
Okay, those are some big questions. And I want to take you back, because it's related to an earlier question you asked about privacy.
Yes.
I think today we're in a situation where it's now technically possible for governments to monitor whole populations. And it's also then possible for them to manipulate populations. And that goes, in a sense, to the heart of the democratic process of people exercising their political choices and informing themselves and so on. So I mean, this particular case is just a sharp point of a much bigger debate. In terms of journalism, the capacity for especially investigative journalists, but for all journalists essentially, have confidence that they can talk to people confidentially, that they can offer sources at least a reasonable assurance that if they come and provide information, if they act as whistleblowers, if they talk to the media, it's not going to be very easy for the state to monitor what a journalist does, who he talks to, who he calls, who calls him. I think part of the indication of where this case began was the interception of a source conversation or a confidential conversation that I had, and this judgment is beautifully written in many cases,
yeah.
And it's a model of clarity. But where the judge deals with this is quite interesting. He talks about the fact that freedom of expression, freedom of the media, is part of a constitution, although it doesn't address confidentiality of sources.
Yes.
And he says, yet if the output is so highly valued, why ought we to be precious about recognizing the critical instrumentality of confidential sources in producing that valuable output?
Mm.
It is somewhat mealy-mouthed to proclaim the press as a bastion of democracy and then choose to ignore the realities of how information is gathered to enable the press to fulfill that role.
Mm.
And for us, this is very, very important judgment, because the freedom of journalists not to disclose their sources, not to be forced to disclose their sources, is not in our law. And I think this judgment goes some way to further kind of entrenching the judicial recognition of that confidentiality.
As a sidebar, a parting question, do you think as journalists and as the media fraternity, we're bad at explaining that to the public? Or we just live in weird times where the crooks try to sully public understanding of journalism? Because it's amazing to me how many people do not understand what you have just excerpted from the judgment. People who think that we should simply name sources and do not understand how, as Ilya correctly said, the enjoyment even of your civil and political rights will be reduced if Sam can't incentivize a whistleblower to reach out to him.
Yeah, look, we're in a state in the world where, you know, populists the world over, people who don't want accountability and transparency are attacking the media as an institution, because whether it performs that function well or whether it fails sometimes, that is its role.
Yeah,
and I think that's also why we're now seeing attacks on judges and so on, because the kind of authoritarian populists among us, be they Trump or be they closer to home, don't want that kind of rules-based, accountability-based governance, which is at the heart of our constitution, and we're fighting to defend that.
Absolutely. Well, you do excellent work consistently despite the trolling. Sam, thanks so much for coming on. I'm going to say goodbye to you at this point. Thank you for your insights. That was Sam Soul. He is a journalist and, of course, at the heart of this particular case. We'll take a break. I'm still with Dr. Ilya Siatitsa, who is the legal officer with Privacy International. I want to know from her in particular what the experiences are globally. Can we learn lessons from other jurisdictions, from other democracies, and have them inform best practice here in South Africa? And then I'm still with Professor Jane Duncan. I want to pick up where Sam had left us there and to place some of the legal issues within the political context in South Africa. You and I have just lived through, and we probably are still living through, the securitization of the state, which is one of her research interests. And where does today's conversation land in relation to that bigger concern of the politicization of the security cluster and the securitization of our politics?
Eusebius Makaiser.
Eusebius Makaiser.
On 702.
17 minutes before 11 o'clock, if you have just tuned in, we're in the middle of a fascinating conversation of legal, political importance to all of us, and that is about the tension between the duty of the state to keep us safe, but our desire to have maximum freedom, including the right to privacy. What does that mean, for example, in terms of the state's entitlement to conduct surveillance? A couple of things here we want to slow down, then I want to get back to Dr. Siatitsa from Privacy International, but I want to start firstly again with you, Professor Duncan. Step one, you wanted to make the point, as you said off air, that this is about journalism and about lawyers, but there are also reasons why the average Joe or someone who's not a professional journalist should care about this conversation in terms of the practical implications for them.
Yes, I think the average Joe should very much care.
Or the average Jane.
Or the average Jane should care, particularly in view of what has come into the public domain during the course of the court hearing. And I was also making a point to you, Eusebius, off air, that we have, ironically enough, Arthur Fraser, former Director General of the SSA, Arthur Fraser, to thank for a huge amount of information that's been put into the public domain about how mass surveillance operates in the country. Now, how does this touch you as an average Joe or an average Jane? Think about this. If you share a message, an intimate message, or an intimate video, let's say, with your nearest and dearest, and perhaps send your nearest and dearest a message saying, "Ooh, baby, imagine this in your mouth." How would you feel about that intimate video landing up in a state database? That is how it impacts you. Think about your most intimate details being collected, processed, and analyzed and being stored for indefinite periods by the state. Now, one of the most significant things about this judgment is that it has declared as unlawful, without a suspension period, the bulk surveillance activities of the National Communications Center. Bulk surveillance is effectively untargeted surveillance. It's surveillance that takes place of large amounts of information without there being a reasonable suspicion of criminality. So it takes place on an untargeted basis, and typically bulk surveillance is directed at what is known as foreign signals intelligence gathering, in the spook speak. Now, what that relates to is it's intelligence that's derived from communications that has one leg in the country and one leg outside of the country, or alternatively, both legs outside of the country. Now, the reason why the spooks argue that these kinds of untargeted surveillance powers are necessary is because outside your own country, you typically have fewer investigative powers than you do inside the country. So it's a big world out there. There are hostile actors. You have to find some way of getting the intelligence that you need in order to protect the country. And many countries engage in these practices. So it could potentially be detrimental to the national security of the country if you two didn't have those powers. However, what we've learned from the information put into the public domain through this case is that the State Security Agency and its National Communications Center cannot distinguish between local signals and foreign signals.
Wow.
So it's saying that when it undertakes mass surveillance, it cannot tell whether that information is coming from a South African or whether it's coming from a non-South African. And that is why I'm saying that potentially your intimate videos that you've sent to your nearest and dearest could be implicated in all of this.
Oh, I see. That makes sense. I want to bring you back in here, Ilya. Earlier, Jane was referring to the context in the USA after 9/11 and also in England after 7/7. I was a resident in England during that time. There was a massive public debate around this. Every second campus university debating society were debating the old chestnut, whether civil liberties should be compromised in the interest of national security. And of course, the state itself was grappling with what that question means. What can we learn from global best and worst practices when it comes to trying to solve that conundrum?
Well, to begin with, you are absolutely right. There has been an extensive debate, especially in the UK and the US, especially after the sensation that Snowden revelations caused. But similarly to the debate we're having now in South Africa, this debate started after mass surveillance practices have already had already been in place for at least a decade, which it's already the first major problem we are facing worldwide at the moment. The intelligence agencies thought that it was justified to impose such intrusive surveillance measures without having any public debate, without having any check and balances, and just operate in secret and unchecked. And that has been an attack not only to the right to privacy, but to democratic values and freedoms as a whole. And therefore, already for me, as was already said, what the South African decision brings into the debate is very, very important. Both because it declares straightforward that such practices are unlawful and they cannot be implied in existing provisions. They cannot be simply be construed from other obligations, from other permissions. And also exactly it reverses the myth that this concerns only foreign signals. Exactly as it was already mentioned by the professor, actually the judgment itself says that it's not possible to differentiate. And so these measures concerns both residents and non-residents. And this is something that other governments have yet still to acknowledge that it's the case. So that's very important for the global debate.
Dr. Siyatitsa, I want to ask you whether there are countries relatively similar in their political or legal orientation as ours, where the oversight mechanisms work a little bit better than the ones that we have here. There's such a huge backlog, for example, and the document, the press statement to which your name is signed, mentions this, a backlog of inquiries being made to, for example, the Office of the Inspector General of Intelligence in terms of them dealing with particular queries from ordinary citizens. Are there other countries in the global north or elsewhere where watchdog bodies, statutory bodies doing oversight work, do that work in terms of the letter and spirit of the oversight regulations that had been written up that one can learn from? Or is it a hot mess everywhere?
Well, I'm unfortunately have to declare that it is the latter. in countries like the UK and France, where I know for fact we've been trying to figure out what data, for instance, have been held by UK intelligence agencies on Privacy International itself and its staff, it has been next to impossible. Through very lengthy proceedings that basically ended up in certain instances by an acknowledgement that, oh yes, we had, but we now deleted it and it's all fine. So you don't need to know why or from when or what, which clearly gives it basically prevents you from any rights to request a remedy.
Wow.
And there are similar cases in France.
Mm.
And slowly, I assume there are countries that they're slowly are trying to put procedures in place. Sweden has been much more advanced in that respect, even though we are still objecting to mass interception practices as a whole as being disproportionate and attacking the essence of the right to privacy. Mm. So we don't think there can be a scheme where mass interception defined as non-targeted surveillance could be justified. But slowly they are slowly putting in place some procedures, already just acknowledging that you're doing mass interception is it's yet to happen in many countries across the globe.
That's
even
true.
Though they are and already that does not help in pushing forward any discussion of procedural or other safeguards.
Absolutely.
And one final point to be made is that having an obligation to notify, it's essential. And this is something, as already was discussed, the High Court puts forward, at least with targeted communications.
Professor Duncan, we've got 3 minutes left. I want to ask you 2 related final questions. We have learned through great investigative journalism in the first instance, not least the Republic of Gupta and also before that, the President's Keepers, that our intelligence structures were captured. How significant is this kind of excellent judicial intervention in relation to the securitization of our politics? And then given that, what should be the posture of the Ramaphosa-led government in relation to this case as it responds to it in the days and weeks ahead?
I think in response to your first question, I'm sorry, I've just gone blank. Can you perhaps...
The securitization of our politics was a massive part of the way in which the looters were able to feed from the trough. And this is a beautiful moment reaffirming transparency, right? So while we talk about journalism and about lawyers and about your porn that you send to your lover not being intercepted, there's a bigger game at stake here. And it's wrestling back control over intelligence so that the bad guys have less opportunity to use intelligence for corrupt and other ends.
Yes, I think that this has played a major role in doing exactly that. And I think it's also, just combining your first and second question, I think it's now put the government on terms.
Yes.
And it's put the government on terms in a way that forces it to respond where it has been dragging its feet. So, for instance, I was part of a Human Rights Committee hearing about 3 years ago, where most of these weaknesses in RICA were actually pointed out to the South African government. And in fact, the government had been required to do reporting on the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And they had taken 4 years in order, 14 years in order to deliver a written response. Not 14 months, but 14 years. So they've been dragging their feet. The Department of Justice should have done a lot more work in actually coming up with an alternative to the deficiencies in RICA. And I think that this is the big win in this particular case, that it provides us with one tool to be able to roll back a lot of the massive securitization of the state that has been happening for a number of decades now. It's not just peculiar to the Zuma administration. It intensified under the Zuma administration. But I think we've still got a lot of doctrinal work to do to make sure that we don't increasingly identify social problems as security problems, 100%. And more specifically, national security problems. And for as long as we have an overbroad definition of national security, we're going to continue to have to fight these battles in courts, in newsrooms, in whatever terrain that we can find to make sure that we extract accountability from these agencies.
100%. Dr. Ilia Siatitsa, Legal Officer, Privacy International, it's been a delight having you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Professor Jane Duncan, as always, pardon the pun, magisterial. Thank you for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.